Thanks, Jen. It's Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, and it is time to reload this week's news. Lots to talk about, the biggest stories, winners, losers, overreported, underreported. What story took you down the rabbit hole, and which story from this week's going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 5,500 years? I still have bets on the meteorite story. They found a little piece of the meteorite in Michigan, and they're investigating, they're exploring. I just feel like something's going to come out of that that ruins our society.
They're trying to tell us it's very mundane makeup.
That's what they want you to believe, Craig. That's what they want you to believe. In studio tonight, Craig Newman. He's a regular here on the Download. He covers, he's always on the Reload, and he's a freelance newsman, we'd say, a veteran newsman, journalist, Sun-Times, Cranes, other places. Good to see you, bud. Thanks
good
for being here.
Freeload, freelance.
Freeload, freelance. Randy Bellisomo, our brethren over at TV side. She is a reporter on WGN-TV. Randy, great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Justin.
All right, so let's get to it. I guess biggest story of the week. We start. There wasn't a lot of debate in our circles today. It has to be the memo. What do you think of what happened today and what happened in the subsequent days leading up to this?
What a confusing jumble of nonsense. Everybody was drawing comparisons to the Al Capone vault, and there really are a lot of similarities. It seems to be kind of a nothing burger, but now Nunez is promising more.
See, I want to hear this because I was telling Pete earlier, I'm like, this has been, indictment of my Twitter feed. In the way that, you know, we talk about bubbles that we live in. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, the people that I follow, friends, but also news, everyone, same thing, Craig, nonstop, like nothing burger, this a waste, all this retweets. And I'm like, there has to be another side to this and the side that I'm not privy to. Randy, why did you say really?
I think the side, so yesterday I was covering this at WGN and we were looking for Democratic input, and Mike Quigley was on CNN the night before, who's saying it's like a high school junior who stays up all night to do a book report and he hadn't read the book and he's had two Red Bulls under his belt. He was dismissing it as it shouldn't go out. And then reading it today, I didn't get the high school book report since based on my high school book reports based on I hadn't read the book at all, so I felt like that effort to tamp it down so much made me want to read it more.
Well,
and then I'm thinking, like, I wanted to bring up the issue of making things public. It seemed like the Republicans in this instance are taking a side that has long been championed by the most progressive of all
of
people looking for access, transparency. And Democrats are on the side of what was long the conservative position. So I think that making things public has long been the liberal viewpoint.
I was watching, I can't remember, Pete told me the name of the guy, I just caught it on CNN. I think it was Wolf Blitzer talking about it. But they made the point about this that I thought held most in my heart was this concept of, listen, there are a lot of things that go into a FISA warrant or to get a warrant to tap anything. I mean, you have to do hundreds of pages, and that they take it very seriously there. And when they say that a 3-page memo is out of context, that's what they're talking about. They're saying that there are a lot of different things in here that they can't tell you about that are serious things they have to do to get this warrant, and that it's a little belittling or possibly dangerous to just say, oh, yep, they tricked the FISA judge. Because it really doesn't work that way.
Yeah, especially for a U.S. citizen. You know, there are innumerable hoops, some of which, you know, we only have the vaguest of notions about. I'm with Randy on this, that for years people have been trumpeting clarity in terms of information coming out of the government. That's not what this is, though. It's this very small, truncated, highly partisan in many ways piece of information. You know, you've got Democrats on the committee arguing that their version of the memo should be released. Paul Ryan saying, well, maybe in time, we got to look at it first. The FBI is screaming about it. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. You've got the intelligence community that's both mum but also somewhat unhappy about it. And there's just not enough fact behind it to really warrant taking it seriously yet. And it contradicts itself in some ways as well in terms of timing. you know, what the vaunted Steele dossier really means to the investigation, what the Papadopoulos angle is to it, when investigation started into one guy and when they launched into the next guy. You know, Carter Page is a declared foreign agent. So, and he's been on the FBI and Fed's radar for 4 years now, 5 years now, I think since 2003 anyway.
I just, I thought about it. I mean, I know nothing about the FISA warrant process and the FISA court and everything involved. The memo makes it seem that it's easily trickable and that they are kind of out to lunch.
Right.
And you can see how a FISA court, and what I was hearing today and reading about, is that that is not the right way to portray that court. That court is a very serious entity.
And what, a couple of weeks after the Republican-owned Congress voted to re-up the FISA rule, you know, to allow FISA tapping of, in particular, U.S. citizens to occur when you go through the FISA court process. So it's kind of a mystifying argument that's being made around something that they just voted to maintain. And
this story is really a complex, and I do not think I covered the story. I was at work for 11 hours yesterday, and I still don't feel like I understand it all, so I don't know about the average American news consumer. But here's the thing, like, to play the, you know, this fairly, if this were a GOP Koch brothers super PAC who put the surveillance on a Hillary Clinton aide, the people on your Facebook page in the bubble would be up in arms.
Right.
So I think that this is fair. This is an issue. I don't know if it's as big a bombshell as everybody thought it would be, but hello, there's playing politics and law enforcement. That's a problem.
Yeah, and I will say one of the things that really hurts this has been the blow up to, or the lead up to it, meaning everybody talking on both sides, as you mentioned, but even the Republicans and in some ways the media, or conservative media, talking that this is going to blow the lid off, this is going to be huge. And it really is something, if you are a news consumer, and myself, I consider myself, when I saw the stuff, I'm like, I've already read about that. Mm-hmm. I've already read about that. This doesn't seem to be blowing the lid off anything. This essentially is what the columnists have been writing about for the last couple months.
And not just the so-called liberal media, the New York Times, the Washington Post. The Wall Street Journal has been doing some fantastic reporting on this leading up to it, and they've had a lot of details. I think they just had a report yesterday, maybe the day before, that put forth a lot of the information that we saw in here, but with a lot more detail behind it, a lot more reporting. Yeah, I mean, there's been so much buildup about this. You know, it's like the blockbuster that fizzles. It's kind of hard to fault it, the news cycle in that respect. But then again, you know, I guess I'm a little bit jaded in expecting something like this to come out on a Friday and be important. And the Friday, the week of the State of the Union, you know, you're completely stealing the thunder of your leader of your party.
But was there thunder?
Well, no. We're going to get to that coming up. It's hard to believe that the State of the Union was this week as well, as we reload this week's news. What happens next? I mean, there has been so much talk, especially when you from columns and articles kind of looking down the road. If the president wants to fire some of the top heads of the FBI or the Department of Justice, does this memo give him the opportunity to do so? And could that mean in a way that it could be spark the end of the Robert Mueller investigation and firing Robert Mueller? I mean, there's a lot. It seemed like that was what was set up. But this sort of being a dud, does it hurt that theory? Does it hurt the idea that the president could go ahead and do these things?
I mean, with this president, I don't know. He's not going to hold to, you know, any norms or standards. He sails his own ship. So, yeah, I don't know.
But what I don't understand is why Christopher Wray's name has been, you know, circulating as he's in trouble, where he wasn't leading the FBI at the time of the alleged wrongdoing.
And he was
so I don't understand, other than
Trump,
that he disagreed with the person who appointed him. Is that cause for him to be axed? I don't understand the connection there. Maybe.
Well, I think it gets back to the loyalty thing that keeps coming up with Trump and demands for various, you know, government officials to remain loyal to the president as opposed to the Constitution or their oath.
Yeah. Let's go to 312-981-7200. Let's bring in Jamie. Jamie, what's your thought on this story?
Well, I think you guys are kind of missing a very important point here. During an election, we have an investigation of one of the candidates, and you better have very good evidence that there's some wrongdoing there, and I don't see that there's enough that that there should have been anything to investigate it.
Hmm. Okay, that's a good question.
Well, because basically what you're looking at, if you do this, then it becomes more of a politically motivated situation. So there better be something there, and it better be definite.
Can we be specific?
And I don't see it.
Yeah,
it was an investigation into an aide to a candidate who the candidate dismisses.
Why were they investigating him?
That's a fair question, but I want to say that there wasn't an investigation into the candidate himself.
What was there to investigate the aide?
Well, he's been on the FBI's radar and the Fed's radar for a couple of years now because of his connections in Russia, because of contacts he's had with Russian officials, various academics.
There was even a story that the FBI came to him and said, "Listen, we think you might be actually be compromised at some point." So yeah,
he had spent time in the Kremlin. I think I've read that he has spent extensive time in the Kremlin.
I don't know, and thanks, Jamie, for the call. The question, I mean, I wonder if the American people could come together on the idea that if there is this thought that is coming through in intelligence that some people who are working for a candidate, maybe not the candidate, you're right, not Donald Trump, but people who work, Paul Manafort comes to mind, Carter Page comes to mind, that have had ties with foreign agents, it is, I think, appropriate to investigate whether or not they are being corrupted. Now, how you do that is what the memo is about, meaning did they do it the right way? Did they withhold information by trying to get the warrant? Did the FBI use politics and partisan politics, which I think is kind of ironic's not the right word, but there was so much made on the liberals or the Democrat side that Obama should have done more. Mm. You know, there was so much, you know, while this was happening that he should do something and he stayed out of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that now it's about how partisan and they were,
what he did,
the White House was for, Hillary Clinton, even though this was the Justice.
I think it's important to remember, too, that Trump didn't really have access to what you would call the A-team of foreign policy experts coming out of the conventions. He was anathema within the party. They were kind of scrambling, trying to figure out how to back him, who to back.
That's right. There was thoughts about maybe replacing him at the convention. You're absolutely right.
Sure. Yeah. And so then you end up with a Carter Page. And, you're not going to get the top name foreign diplomats. And he severely downplays the idea of diplomacy.
He was
going pretty hard at the intelligence community. He was pretty limited in his choice of people he listened to.
You're right. He ran as an outsider. And a lot of those guys, because I remember we were on the show with Touche, with Roebling and Lundy. And Roebling, the Republican, saying, "Paul Manafort, I don't know if you're running as an outside campaign, why you'd have that guy. Mm-hmm. He's got such dirty laundry all over his stuff."
And very he mentioned shiny Russia. Suits, yeah, lots of right. them.
Craig Newman, Randy Dellasoma in studio. We are reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break. We'll come back, and we'll start with the winners and losers. Stay with us. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Lots of people texting in about the memo today, and Mary has the best quote. Justin and Guess, am I the only one who had to look up the word dossier? Can't stop thinking about it.
That word they keep using, it just makes it seem fun.
269 says, if the FBI was biased against the Trump administration, you can bet it wasn't political, but rather biased against anyone who would conspire with the Russians. Which is that's a very interesting point, the idea that could you say that maybe there was bias because they felt that this candidacy, or not candidacy, but this campaign was conspiring?
I suppose, but I think there's better, more efficient ways to torpedo a campaign than this roundabout. Let him get elected, start pulling all these cast of characters in. I mean, you think about the leaks that came out of the New York field office around the Clinton campaign, in the summer and coming out of the conventions again and leading up to the general election. That's, pretty devastating stuff that built up over emails that may or may not have been smoking guns. It just seems like there'd be a better way if you're really interested in torpedoing.
630 says, I truly believe media is such a homogenous bubble that they can't see the bias here. Imagine Bush using Russian agents and RNC-funded soaker to obtain wiretaps on Obama.
630, that's what I said.
Yeah, I'd be outraged. Yeah, that's what they say.
Well, I said what you said that I didn't say. So I'm making the same argument on WGN Radio. Right. So
this conversation is like the memo in microcosm. Right, I said, you said this.
But you're right. Like,
but you're right about transparency. It used to be a Democrat thing, and now it's.
I said, could you imagine if somebody did the same thing to Hillary Clinton aide? Oh, the world would be outraged. Yeah. So yeah, I'm with you.
All right, let's move on to winners and losers, and I would definitely want to talk about Illinois politics this week. It's amazing to me that we have been in a position where the state of the state was this week, and Jeannie Ives versus Bruce Rauner at the Chicago Tribune editorial board was this week as well. That seems like it was a month ago. But Jeannie Ives, on your list as winners, we'll start there. She had a strong showing. I mean, the headlines alone were like Drubs or Beats.
And Rauner had very little comeback. You know, the key line when Jeannie Ives said, and he even lied to the cardinal about the taxpayer funding for abortion and Medicaid, and he just said, that's outrageous. I mean, there was nothing. She just seemed to destroy him with every answer, and then after that, she got $500,000from an ex-Rauner supporter. Right. And so things were really, really going her way. But then this afternoon, or late yesterday, this ad became airable, yeah. Visible. It's not being aired in Chicago, but I'm going to let you guys talk about
the ad. All right, so this is an ad that came out this afternoon that is attack ad on Rauner that uses caricatures, liberal caricatures, saying, thank you, Rauner, for letting me protest or sanctuary states. Thank you, Rauner, for letting me use the girls' bathroom.
A hairy man dressed up as a dress.
I mean, it's a very offensive commercial. There's a thank you, Obama, for letting me thank you, Rauner, for letting me have an abortion. Like, the woman with a pink hat on, like, who was marching.
Thanks for paying for all my abortions.
It's startling. It's startling how offensive and caricatured.
I don't know if there's a stereotype generator that you can use to make political ads, but she clearly found it and ran this ad through several times. You know, I was gobsmacked on the way over. I was on the train watching this thing. I think my jaw was actually on the floor. I don't know how you produce an ad like that in this day and age. But I know it'll play well with some of the quote-unquote base.
I mean, she's playing to a conservative base, and these are all liberal caricatures that in the cartoon. I love that. Freudian slip. It's very, very cartoonish.
It does have a little bit of a cartoon feel.
Yeah, in the ad, it essentially is thanking Rauner for, and all these liberals thanking Rauner for helping them out. So, I mean, it does play to her conservative base.
And that is her audience. Remember, she entered this race after the abortion decision by the governor, going against what everybody assumed that he was backing with the cardinal, and he was not running on social issues. He didn't care about social issues, and everybody said, well, he did it because of his wife, and that's when she entered the race, and there are a lot of people that care about that issue and care about the fact that it was just such a stunning reversal. What mm-hmm. he did and what he said are just two different things, and so that's what she's going after. But I think I don't think we'll see it in this area, but yeah. I was shocked the depictions of what she put
in
there.
I think it's pretty clearly an anti-Rauner ad, obviously, but it's an anti-Chicago ad.
Yeah,
it's going to the rest of the state and saying, you know, it's them. It's the it's the, you know, the teachers who are of a different race. It's the transgender people. It's the people who are soaking off the public fountain. It's something.
I thought we would hear from transgender advocacy groups at least by this time.
I mean, you probably still. This just came out today, but it is stunningly, if off color, if not offensive. But I mean, yeah, you're right. Absolutely playing towards us versus them, and the idea that if you live in Chicago, you're a liberal. immoral liberal who wants to use other people's bathrooms or whatever they're going for.
And that had to have been produced before Monday, because I would say after Monday and after the infusion of cash, it seemed like she had all this momentum, and that was already sitting in her office waiting to be released. She didn't have to do that.
And to be fair, it was released by Rich Miller and Capital Facts, so it hasn't yet hit. And Dan Proft even came out and said, we're not sure, you know, I'm not sure we're going to air it.
Although I would say the production values aren't the highest. It's possible that Yulian 500K just went straight into the meme generator.
Mm.
Well, it's Jeannie Ives does stay on the winner list for her trouncing of the governor. Now, the governor has said, that's it. We're not going to do any more debates. We're not talking again. This is it. I'm not giving any more space to breathe.
Now, is she a winner or is he just such a big loser at this point that she elevates a status or two
by
default?
I mean, he had and it's a tough week for him, and we'll get to that. I mean, the state of the state, he gets the opportunity with the state of the state and the budget address to have the pulpit. I mean, to be up behind the podium and get everybody's attention. So that is a plus for the governor going into a contested primary. Craig Newman, Randy Bellisomo in studio. We're reloading this week's news. We come back, we'll stick with the winners and then get into losers. That's the best part. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Yeah. It's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Randy Bellisomo, Craig Newman in studio. We're reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. We are in the winners and losers. So another winner, and if we stay in the winner category before we get to the losers, which everybody loves, let's talk about Daniel Biss, the state senator who is running for governor on the Democratic side. The first real polling came out, and surprise, surprise, he was number two. Well, that's surprising. Everyone thought it was a race between Chris Kennedy and J.B. Pritzker, but Daniel Biss moves into the second spot. Did that surprise you, Craig?
I think it was a pretty big surprise. I mean, you know, he had a little momentum. He's got a little bit of name recognition around the city. But, you know, I think Pritzker going after him with these attack ads is really going to elevate him a little bit. And I think it started to do that. You know, they're having to pay attention to him. Kennedy just can't get any traction. And, you know, sort of by default, Biss is rising up a little bit. And I think people are wary about billionaires.
Last week the news was that Senator Biss had had raised more money than Kennedy in January. So, I mean, you start to see he's also timed his ads in a different way that they're starting to hit now, where Kennedy inexplicably ran him around Christmas time. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot about campaign strategy and what goes into it.
Says Christmas like some good advertising for, you know, campaigns.
The big story, though, from the poll, it's great for Daniel and the fact that he's number two in this poll, is a wide margin. And they have the Pritzker name recognition of something 30-some-odd points or something. I mean, it's not a close race. It just was more close. It was closer between second and third than it is to the front runner.
Yeah, but you could make the argument. I mean, does Biss really think he can win the Democratic nomination? I don't know. Maybe he does. I guess you have to go into these campaigns thinking you can win. Or is this about something bigger? You know, is this setting up a run for a national office? Is this setting up a run for a broader office in a couple of years down the road?
Like what?
I don't know.
Congress, yeah. Congress, maybe. Statewide office, like, I don't know, replace Jesse White. Then.
Yeah, well, it's got to happen one day.
One of these days, right? But, you know, because it's funny because Biss had thought to be interested in the comptroller and he was raising money for that, and then he backed off of that, and then or maybe it was treasurer, one of the two, but then ended up running for governor, just going for it. So you may be right on that. Randy, are you sick of the election yet?
Not yet.
Or is
yet.
It just heating up? It's
just like the things that happen that are so out of the blue, you know, where Kennedy can't think of a nice thing to say about J.B. Pritzker, and then Pritzker puts out a website about all the bad things he can say about Dan Biss. The surprises are numerous enough that keep me interested, yeah. Especially the ad on the Republican side. So I will be, but I'm not there yet. I think I keep thinking that the Kennedy brand operation is strong enough somewhere to finally get some traction. Yeah. And I keep thinking it's going to happen, but I don't know if you guys agree with me.
You might be the wrong Kennedy.
Yeah. Well, I have in the loser category as well, and I put Ives in the category too, just because it's about campaign ads. I thought that Pritzker's ad as well this week, in which it was released that he just had footage of Jeannie Ives beating up on Bruce Rauner in the Tribune editorial board, you know, where she was beating him and he was laughing, and it was like it was a negative ad. And at the end, you think it's for Ives because it was just showed her in a good light, and it says Pritzker for governor. You're like, what does that have to do with you? I mean, that again, like, why are you in there? Just like Rauner the week before was in there with the Blagojevich tapes on Pritzker. I'm like, just, guys, stick to your own primary. Get to the general stuff coming up.
Which I don't know if I can take several months of Rod Blagojevich tapes, to be honest with you. I mean, can we just be done with that at some point?
Years.
Yeah. You've got, Randy, you've got winners outside of politics. South Shore residents. Why?
Right. Because, well, for about 5 years now, the South Shore neighborhood has been a food desert on 71st since the Dominicks left in 2013. And Alderman Leslie Harrison has been working and working and working to get the mayor to come through with his promise to end or reduce the number of food deserts in the city. And remember, he put 10 biggest crises that were facing the city when he first ran for mayor years ago. Deserts was number one.
And a big deal about the Whole Foods that moved in Inglewood.
Right, which wasn't technically a food desert because there was an Aldi really nearby. And all that time when Whole Foods was going in, Leslie Harrison was saying, we have nothing in South Shore. And so finally, Shop and Save just signed a letter of intent to go into the Jeffrey Plaza on 71st Street. And that was filling a desperate need. And, you know, I was thinking back about all the coverage of food deserts, and we don't hear about it a lot anymore. Right. Frankly, I think it's because the Emanuel administration has not made as much progress as it said that it would on the issue, and they even changed the definition of food desert or in residents and the population where food deserts could be applicable to only low-income residents. So they reconfigured
what it means,
what it meant, so their statistics and progress would go up, and it is a real unfinished business on the part of the mayor's administration, but this Shop and Save was a great step for the people in South Shore because that neighborhood needs it, and there's been a lot of crime. I've covered crime on that stretch of 71st that has happened in the years since Dominic's
and
closed.
Could you imagine, I mean, for a lot of our listeners who are listening right now, living in a community where there just wasn't a grocery store.
Right.
Where the only place you could get any sort of goods that you could survive on was the gas station or the 7-Eleven. For a lot of our listeners who live in communities in the western suburbs, northern suburbs, northwest suburbs, south suburbs.
It's hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine. All right, so keeping on winners, I just put this on the winners, fact-checking websites. That made it because of the State of the Union. There was a story that one of the fact-checking websites, I forgot which one, actually was down the night of the State of the Union because so many people wanted to check and see what was true and what wasn't from the president's speech.
Interesting.
So that's I guess, is winners for the fact that we're being learned, if you will, that there are organizations that you can go to see if the politicians are speaking truth.
It's certainly a cottage industry cropping up, but I have trouble figuring out. I think there's plenty of appetite for fact checking. I have trouble figuring out how many people are actually buying into the fact checking because nobody has standard definition for what facts are anymore.
Right. Although, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
It's I don't know. It's a little bit of a
you're absolutely
a head
right because for the president to say it's the lowest unemployment of African American Hispanics, he's right. That is a fact. He's right. Now the fact checking sites will say, well, it's been on a decline for the last 10 years, so it's a little disingenuous to say that it's the lowest because it was going there anyway. But he is right.
Or even more basic, that he had the highest rating ever for a State of the Union, which is, you know, easy to disprove, and yet people were still buying into that.
I love it. I love. I don't know what it is. There's something about this president, and I cannot wait for all the biographies on him for his time in office. That does he put that stuff out because he just loves how everyone just kind of goes rabid over these facts and figures and fiction and all that kind of stuff, because everyone gets so worked up over what he probably just kind of snickers as he tweets into that.
I just think he's a lifelong marketer, and marketer's going to market.
Circus Barker, man,
And you're always going to have to add a little bit of flair.
I think he gets a little thrill when it makes everybody go crazy. I mean, it's nice to have everybody, for a very short moment, to have everybody reacting to what you say. Why do we all go on the radio?
Yeah, there you go. Other winners, the Chicago Bulls, I guess, would be in the winner category with the trade of Nikola Mirotic. It didn't seem like he was going to be able to be tradable. He turned it on. They were able to get rid of him, and they got something in return. Maybe a first-round pick and Omer Asik. I mean, what do you think, Craig?
Anything any movement for the Bulls these days. I mean, it's going to be sad that there's no more Fight Club. That might be the most watchable thing about them as the season kind of winds down. But, you know, it's what, a first-round pick, and I guess Omer Asik is back, you know, great. I mean, you know, but what are they going to be able to do with
it? If they are a team that is in rebuild, that might even be a purposeful tank, if you want to go there. Acquiring first-round picks for bench players, not bad. Top 10. It could be a top 10 pick.
It could very well be. Do you buy into this management regime to make good use of a first-round pick?
Yeah, that's a different issue, different story. You're absolutely right. They have not shown. I mean, all you have to do is look at Doug McDermott and Denzel Valentine, and down the line they've had first round picks and they have not done well with them. You're right, they got lucky on Derrick Rose.
That was actual magic
for a little bit.
All right, so let's turn to the losers. We'll do this, we'll take a quick break, we'll come back and we'll get to the losers, because we have a lot to get to tonight, a lot of diverse stuff. Randy Bellisomo, Craig Newman in studio. We're reloading the news. Stay with us. Yeah, I have the groundhog on my over-reported.
Which one?
There's a million of them. I saw a graphic from Pennsylvania. There's got to be at least a half dozen just in that state now.
I just feel like that's every year I could say overreported. I've lost interest in the tradition that is getting a groundhog to.
I will watch the movie though.
Yeah, the movie's great.
I wonder if a groundhog makes a good pet.
Yeah, that's a good question.
No, they're nasty.
Are they nasty?
Feral rodents.
Really.
Wasn't it De Blasio that was trying to pick it up and it bit his hand and they dropped it and it died like 3 days later?
Oh. Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
When groundhog political stunts go awry, yeah. You can find that on the internet. Greg Newman, Randy Bellisomo in studio, are reloading this week's news. Let's get to the losers. This is what everybody loves. Let's start. I really, really like your collection, Randy, especially when we talk about the Miglin family. You know, we'll get into some more serious stuff, but that the Miglin family, it is serious. And we're talking about the show on FX, which is about the Versace story, and it's getting a lot of great buzz for the show. But you're right, Chicago plays a big role, and it was about the Miglin family, and they went through the ringer, and here they are on TV being fictionalized. You're right, not great to have your name come back again.
No, and especially given that, and I was not in Chicago. I was growing up, but this is national news then, and I remember watching this primarily because my mother wore Miglin makeup, and so this was just it's like a death in the family. Marilyn's husband was murdered, and all the way, and we were in Memphis, Tennessee. But I'll tell you that reading from my journalist perspective now, how the newspapers in Chicago seem to have treated the Miglin family at the time of the murder, that there were many speculations of what was going on between Cunanan and Lee Miglin, or Marilyn and Lee Miglin's son, Duke, that it doesn't seem like anybody came out and said it. And I was trying to think, if that had happened in today's world, would we give any Chicago icon or leading figure the same sort of respect? I don't think we would. I don't think anybody is that loved or that we're that respectable. And so how it was treated then, and then all these years later, it being put on the screen in a very popular show, FX, which I think they're doing a great job in terms of telling a story, but just putting myself in the Miglin family's shoes and seeing that. And then what they did, if you're not watching the show, is that they created a lot of the dialogue between gay lovers that they assume happened that night prior to the killing between Andrew Cunanan and Lee Miglin, and him kneeling down, Lee Miglin kneeling down before an altar in his house and say, I can't help me. And then he turns to Cunanan turns into this heated affair. And I just know that has to be, I even felt bad sending it to you for my loser pick, because I know that it has to make them feel so horrible watching this.
Yeah, it's hard when you're doing these reenactment type shows that really deal with real people. That's got to be tough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
were you covering news at the time?
I think I was in Boston, so I didn't pay much attention to the story.
Yeah,
to be honest.
Well, okay, that's a great one though. That's one that's a little bit off, because you know, when we start talking about, let's take it back to some of the things that happened this week that we've already kind of touched on. I thought that the State of the Union, I thought Dreamers kind of we're in the loser category just for the all dreamers matter approach of President Trump to essentially
we all have dreams, Justin.
We all have dreams, but to co-opt that word or that phrase and to put it on all Americans.
That was good PR.
It was good PR for them, but puts the dreamers, the DACA recipients in the loser category.
Well, yeah, and I guess there was some reporting around him not wanting Democratic leaders to use the phrase dreamers leading up to the State of the Union because it makes them too approachable and, you know, too sympathetic, and nobody knows what a DACA is.
Right. Well, there you go. The others, I thought there was some other stuff, too. When we get into media, I think there were some stories, even today, the Chicago Sun-Times, making the announcement that Hedy Weiss, the longtime theater critic, is out. She has been terminated. The position has been eliminated. And then just tonight, Richard Roper reinstated after another story this week of him. The New York Times did a big piece about inflated Twitter followers, and they used him as an example. The next day, the Sun-Times comes out, and they didn't use the word suspension, but they said his stuff has been removed. And we're investigating whether, you know, there's a lot that went into the media world this week.
Yeah, yeah, and well, and the Reader named a new executive editor, Mark Conkle.
Who's a winner, not a loser.
Pulitzer Prize winner. So yeah, definitely
big winner.
Yeah, you know what? I think we were talking in the break. This is kind of a loss for cultural criticism in a town that's kind of had it on the wane for a little while. We've got a booming culture scene here, but we don't have a lot of people talking about it in an educated manner. Too often. I mean, Chris Jones is excellent for the Trib, mm-hmm. and then it starts to become kind of a drop-off.
And if you think about New York is known for theater, number two city, I think, would anybody argue with us saying that Chicago is the second biggest theater destination in the country?
Yeah.
And our number two newspaper, or second newspaper, whatever you want to call it, as I sit in the Tribune Tower, is dropped its theater critic. I think it is tragic for arts criticism, because I think we are in the end of arts criticism, and I know that it even for quote-unquote lower arts, I think in 2016 there are only 10 full-time film critics in the country, which is kind of shocking. So you have to think that theater is even lower than that. Yeah. What does this mean? What do people do? There are a number of blogs and websites who are doing this.
Chris Fusco, he came out in the feeder piece today saying, well, we're reimagining how we're going to cover arts and culture.
So what does that mean?
Well, I don't know what it means, but my point being that Hedy Weiss, and we can bemoan the end of cultural criticism as we know it, but she also was a controversial figure.
She had her moments.
She had her. There were a huge theater contingency, alliances and associations that came out and wrote letters. Steppenwolf was a part of it.
They
were very vocal to say, "Hey, we don't really like Hedy Weiss as coming." They said they weren't. She wasn't allowed back in their theaters.
And I thought it was based on one column that she wrote.
Just from my circles in theater, the thought was that was the straw that broke the camel's back. She had a bad review Steppenwolf show. But the point being that there had been bubbles up and bubbling up and bubbling up, and then there was a viral campaign to get every theater in Chicago to make her pay for a ticket. Mm-hmm. Now, and I agree with the idea of cultural criticism being, eliminated, and that's a big issue, and Hedy has had a long, outstanding career here Chicago. But it could also be the fact that, there has still been tension between the theater community and their number one critic.
But, right. I know that this is a controversial topic, but here's the thing. There are two people in Chicago who shine a light on cultural, on the theater arts in Chicago, Chris Jones and Hedy Weiss. And when you have a critic, and I understand where a lot of the controversy was from, but theaters are not always going to appreciate what critics say. And I think that she said some things that probably crossed the line.
Sure.
But I do not like it. I don't like the premise, whereas the person who's being written about gets to determine if the person writing has a job. I think that that's a dangerous thing.
Although we don't know that that was the reason that she was let go today.
No.
From my time there, and it's been a few years at this point, I know that there was a groundswell of unhappiness with her from the theater community, but it never got serious enough that there was any sort of conversation either way.
Right.
You know, that said, when I hear the, you know, anodyne, we're going to rethink how we do cultural criticism. I hope that's true. I hope that there's a good idea in place. But that's, you know, isn't that what is always said when something is lost like this? Of course, you're going to try and rethink it. But, you know, they're in a little bit of a situation because she was a union employee and that's a protected position. So how they do that might
be. So how they say it or how they terminate positions, things like that. And then Richard Roper back tonight. So Richard Roper back in. So
with a brand new Twitter.
An amazing conversation about the ethics of buying Twitter followers. Wherever
you
stand.
So why is that okay?
Well, that's what I mean. It was amazing. I saw thought pieces out of nowhere. I would have been the person who went, I don't care. I really don't care. Because you know what? If you pay close enough attention to the arts, to celebrity, to music, to movie, to filmmakers, they have inflated numbers everywhere they go. They have companies that do it for them. When you're out in LA and you're an actor and you want to get big, you hire a PR company,
Journalist.
I guess he is a journalist, but he's also, to me, he's a celebrity. He's Ebert and Roper. I mean, there's a little bit more to me that he's a personality. He's a guy to put up on the masthead as opposed to a guy with his, you know, like doing objective journalism.
Although,
he's a columnist.
When I started reading the story, I thought, yeah, but doesn't everybody do that? But the more I thought about it, you know, you are misrepresenting what you are as a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a brand as much as he is anything. So when you go out and say, I've got 250,000 Twitter followers, do you?
I don't know.
In my role, in everybody's role in television news, we get a report every morning about social media traffic. And they rank the stations, they rank the personalities, and how much traffic do you generate, and what do you do that gets buzz? And if you had Richard Roper in that metric that all the stations pay for to determine how successful they are online and spreading their news, then that would be it's unfair. It's wrong. It's buying success.
Well, they reinstated him, so I don't know what the deal was of the investigation. But my point being that, you know, I don't know the situation. I can only do what I saw in the newspapers and things like that. But I'm telling you that this is Greg. It's a cottage industry. There is a lot of artists that will hire PR people to get more social media impact. This idea that Rich Roper's in his basement, you know, going, I'm going to click here for $29.99 or $59.99. This is going to make me famous. That's the wrong narrative. That's not accurate.
I was thinking along those same lines, and then I went back and read the New York Times story. And I think it does get a bit deeper than that because there is a big awareness factor. You know, if you're trying to sell an idea of something and you're selling it on a false pretense, whether you're a brand or a personality or whatever, it gets to be dirty and tricky a little bit.
All right, coming up, we got overreported, underreported, we got the rabbit hole, and which story is going to be remembered? Craig Newman, Randy Bellisomo, reloading this week's news, 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Thanks, Jen. There's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up here at 9:30, we're going to talk with Carrie Kennedy. She's going to join us to talk about her new exhibit at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. Carrie Kennedy is the president of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Foundation, of course, the daughter of Robert Kennedy. She will join us. We'll talk about that. And at 10 o'clock, Mavis Staples. How great is that? Randy's got tickets. You got tickets for tomorrow night, huh?
I wouldn't miss her.
Yeah, so
I'm jealous of the tickets. I'm jealous you get to talk to Mavis Staples.
A lot of jealousy going around.
A lot.
It's Friday.
312-981-7200. Randy Bellisomo, reporter at WGN-TV. Craig Newman, who's a longtime freelance but also veteran journalist who worked at places like the Sun-Times and Cranes. We're reloading this week's news. Let's get to overreported and underreported. I'll let the text take the lead on this. Here we go. 847... Overreported the damn peacock therapy animal on the plane story and Groundhog Day. That's from Sue. And there's been a couple today talking about the peacock story.
You can take the groundhog on the plane, though. I mean, you can take anything on a plane.
This is on my list. It's on all of our lists because it's just absurd. And it's one of these stories that everybody has to put in the kicker. Everyone has to talk about a peacock and how planes are saying you can't bring a peacock on. We get it.
It's a great video.
But at the same time, there is some there is a story here.
There's a problem. Sure. Everybody is abusing the rules, and there are real service dogs out there who do real things for people with visual and hearing impairments. Understood, but you can bring. Remember the food allergy, and we many flights we can't have a peanut on the plane, but you can bring a Shetland pony, and that is the truth. Because if you say that you rely on that pony, which is actually one of the approved animals, a miniature horse, that you can have this, and it's so you don't have to go through the hassle of putting it on under the plane, paying for a checked baggage. Here's the thing. I heard it described as Noah's Ark this morning. I think that that's true in all the list of animals that people have been bringing on, and there's been like 150% increase in like the last year. 250,000 emotional support animals on Delta in the past year. And I'm allergic. And let's talk about my allergies. I'm allergic.
talk about
over-reported.
I'm allergic to. I would be absolutely miserable if you brought any feline animal on the plane. But you can bring that on if it makes you feel less sad. But everybody else, I don't know.
But Brandy, the big issue here, and Greg, chime in. But the big issue is, and everyone knows someone who does this, is that it's almost like medical marijuana in California. All you got to do is go in and go, I got anxiety.
Right.
And you can get a letter and you don't have to check your dog. And that's really what it's about. And they mentioned it because it got completely overhyped because of the peacock. But they mentioned Delta, and I think it was United too, that said, listen, we're having issues where the dog defecates, they bark.
Attacks.
They don't understand what they're doing because they're not actual support dogs.
Sure, sure.
They're just being, it's a scam to get on the plane with you.
I will say, though, I'm a little offended, Randy, that Shetland pony is my spirit animal. Well, I will try and keep it off the plane next time.
Well, you know what? Other people don't. And I think that it goes to the point. They just now, Delta had to expand the list today, that they've now banned animals with tusks or hooves.
Wait a minute.
Right? That they have
what kind of an animal?
To do this. So there is an abuse. And I think that who is not being vocal enough are the real people. I mean, do you know the amount of work that goes into training a dog to be a real service animal? And these other pets that bark and defecate and urinate all over the plane is a real just offensive to me.
I want to know what kind of an animal has a tusk that you can get onto a plane.
I'm going to read. Oh, right. I'm
well,
going to get there.
Pony
I've got this whole
a,
list.
No,
yeah.
Not a tusk, but they but, have
and wild boar.
Yeah.
Wild and hooves. And there's these places online where it can connect you to a quote-unquote mental health professional who will give you a list that you have quote-unquote anxiety so you can bring your reptile on Delta.
All right. All right.
What?
All right.
No, do you want to bring your pet
bring,
on the
no,
plane?
I don't want to bring my cat. My cat doesn't even come down for food.
Your cat doesn't like, care about your emotions.
I'm allergic to that.
It is not,
and you can ban peanuts, but I can't ban the cat.
There is no emotional support coming from Mr. Mittens. I'll tell you that right now.
Okay.
So, it would be great to take him on the plane. He would do everything he can to get away from me.
Find him hiding in the engine.
700 animals a day just on Delta.
Wow. I don't think I've ever been on a flight where I've seen an animal.
I've never seen one.
You haven't seen dogs?
No.
Well, they're often covered up. That's the other thing. Like, let's take care of our animals. They're covered up in these cases. Sometimes you don't even know they're in that purse. You know, purse puppies?
The worst part is getting them in the overhead bin.
Ugh.
All right. The other overreported
stories
we had.
I'm emotional about it.
State of the Union, I thought was in the overreported. State of the State as well. You
always.
Just kind of get to the. These are the State of the Union, surprisingly, acting like, oh, well, this is such news. I'm like, then we have one of these every year, and it's always the same, regardless of party. Secondarily, I would say the Super Bowl. Randy, you said in the break that you felt that this was actually a down year when it comes to overhyping the Super Bowl. But I, as a sports fan, the 2 week lead up to this game that is a game is too much. It's
I would feel
much.
Differently if I lived in the Northeast, but I feel like we're spared some of that
because we have terrible teams.
Yeah, and I mean it's just so regional this year. I mean it speaks to the disconnect of the rest of America
between two cities with terrible fan bases.
There you go.
You said it.
Yeah,
I did.
All right.
And I lived in Boston.
Well,
for a while.
We'll get back to the Super Bowl, but underreported. Let's see. What do we have for underreported? I thought that North Korea came up on the list, Randy. You also talked about the. I mean, that obviously dovetails into the Olympics.
The Olympics
which start
are next week,
and we next week.
Yeah, I just remember Olympics. You have How lead up possible? For weeks and weeks and weeks, and this is the Olympic and one of the most. You know. Heightened security places, you know, ever that we've had in Olympics, and so other than the ones that we've skipped, yeah. So I think that we're not paying a lot of attention. Trump did meet with North Korean defectors today. I don't know if anybody knows that. I mean, because I thought it was underreported, and like only one other president has ever done that.
Yeah, and there aren't that many of them. But
right, there aren't that many.
It comes a day after the candidate for the South Korean ambassadorship was withdrawn.
And
now more than ever, we need a South Korean ambassador. Our relationship with them is soured, but with the Olympics coming up, and yeah, it's. Definitely.
The other story that 847 brought in was one we talked about in the 7:30 hour tonight. The situation in Cape Town, South Africa, that by April 12th, they're going to run out of water.
Out of water, yeah.
Oh.
And it is interesting because this is not the first time in human history this has happened. It's usually when you're in drought conditions, the rain comes, and then we didn't think about it. As Josh Ellis from the MPC, Metropolitan Planning Council, was in your chair, Craig, he said this was Illinois back in 2011 when we had drought conditions, and it was an extended drought. Down in the southern part of the state, we were down to 3 months left in some situation. Then it rained, and we forgot about it.
Yeah.
And that happened in California. It rained all last year. So we're like, and here come the drought conditions again.
Mm-hmm.
It does seem to be underreported. For whatever reason, human beings were just not rallying around the idea that on April 12th, the city of what? Millions of people. That's a huge city. Cape Town, South, going to be out of water.
Wouldn't think it would happen there.
Yeah, well, I think some of these things are hard for us to imagine because we live right next to a big lake, or you know, we don't get droughts necessarily in the city.
I guess, man. I feel like nobody in California is paying attention to it either.
No. I think it's the number one global issue.
It's huge. I just don't get why there isn't. I mean, I think look at your feed today. Did you see anything on Cape Town and water in April 12th?
No.
Well, there's also a pretty big dearth of foreign reporting if it doesn't involve North Korea or if it doesn't involve a catastrophe, which this is, it's a slower
it
building.
It just seems like you would
less on Africa.
It'd be really nice to have like a week without, you know, intrigue on Capitol Hill about investigations and partisan politics
a day.
And maybe we all put our attention towards a major city of human beings that are going to be without water in a month.
We've quickly forgotten about the famine in Yemen, but you're right. It's too hard for us to imagine.
You could throw out there Puerto Rico while you're at it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting story this week as well on Puerto Rico, kind of underreported, that FEMA had said, we're done. Mission accomplished. And then the press was so bad, they're like, all right, we'll stay. Essentially, I just summed up the FEMA story there.
Thank goodness for media.
Yeah. Thank goodness for media. Randy Bellisomo, Craig Newman in studio. All right, we'll come back. And we'll do the rabbit hole stories, and then we will pick the stories which will be remembered from this week in 5, 10, 50, 500 years from now. So
five
stay
days.
With us 5 days. Right? Yeah. Cool. I think later in the show, Jen, we'll talk about whether or not we're going to watch that game.
Okay.
I'm deciding. I'm getting closer and closer to making a decision on that. Earlier in the week, I was like, I don't know, man. This might be the one I skip. I don't have no love for either of those teams. I don't like Justin Timberlake, and I don't like the commercial. I don't like commercials.
So well,
I'm such a non-American that un-American that I don't like commercials, but I don't like them.
If you're not going to watch it, hop on WGNRadio.com and follow our live blog.
I haven't watched the NFL in years.
Really?
Yeah. I just can't. I couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. We're getting to the end here, reloading the news. Let's get down the rabbit hole. Now, all right, so why don't we start with you, Randy? You had the story from this week's New Yorker about the case of Jahi McMath. I don't know the story.
Oh, I think it's fascinating. It made headlines a few years ago, and a girl in California, in Oakland, she had surgery for sleep apnea, and something went wrong. It was a tonsillectomy, and something went wrong, terribly wrong, in the surgery. African-American family... reason to be suspicious about what happened to her in the hospital, I think they felt, because it was very routine. And she was declared brain dead. And I think that it's the New Yorker has dedicated a few things this week to the changing definition of death. And people who know me know that I'm into end-of-life issues, yes, which I'm not going to talk about right now. But what I will talk about her is that her family did not accept the diagnosis. And and they said, well, we can't continue to keep her on life support if she is declared dead. Her family had her moved across the country to a different state. In New Jersey, which has a different definition of death. They don't have to accept brain death as death. And she has been kept alive on life support, well, kept blood circulating and heart beating on life support. They've since moved her into an apartment that her family has gone into bankruptcy. Interestingly enough, the New Yorker highlights how she has, even though she's been declared brain dead, she has shown biological signs of adolescence. She began menstruating, and she is developing other situations. And they said, if somebody's brain dead, how can this happen? Wow. Which the family says, well, of course, I told you she wasn't dead at all. And she does have some responses when a family asks, can you move your finger? And maybe 20 seconds later, she does. But we've also seen these videos, if you remember back to the case of Terry Schiavo. Yeah. And those videos, there was a big controversy at the time because they said, well, the family was altering those videos. But then the doctors have said this has actually happened. And so I just think it's a really interesting story about a family who's been through the ringer. And it's fascinating.
That's in the New Yorker.
What's happening.
This week's New Yorker. Mm-hmm. All right, check that out. Craig, you were back to the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You feel like the rabbit hole is a Super Bowl.
Well, football in general. You know, there's a new, I think it's NBC Wall Street Journal poll out today that's showing that support for the NFL is declining, but also support for football in general. You know, we've got plenty of youth teams around here that are folding. Yeah. Schools can't field enough players.
There's an act that went through that's going to be introduced in Springfield, or was introduced in Springfield?
Yeah, the no hitting until, what, 12 or 13?
Which totally makes sense.
It does, but I understand the other side of the argument that then kids are starting to hit without learning how to hit. But, you know, I played football growing up. I used to be a big fan. I still see the sport's obviously popular. But, you know, we were talking a little bit about we haven't seen kind of the hoopla around the Super Bowl going on. And it could be because our team's terrible here. Could be because everybody hates the two teams that are in it. But there does seem to be a vibe. And, it, you know, there's the Colin Kaepernick stuff. There's the CTE issues. There's the fact that the league is just run by some not very nice people.
If the game is supposed to be escapism, and I understand the social issues that are being protested at the national anthem, but to be watching the State of the Union and have the president even make remarks about the National Football League. Yeah, you're right. It just makes you go. It makes you not like the. I hate to do this, but say you don't like the National Football League. And the problem is that might be the intention of the president doing so. But the point being,
he's a Patriots fan.
Yeah.
Well,
he's also a guy who didn't get an NFL team when he wanted to get into ownership,
and which has been under his saddle for a while. Yeah. And then you got the XFL maybe starting up again. But I just think there's something going on with the idea of football in this country. And it, you know, is it at a tipping point? I don't know. But there's some sort of vibe about it that
I'm telling you, I've been saying this for years. Nobody listens to me, and when it happens, everyone's
I listen to you
go,
all the time.
Thanks, Craig. I appreciate that. Robots. The game would be if you made it robots, and you painted the New England thing on the robots, and then when one got hit really hard and its arm fell off, it's the people on the sideline with the soldering guns, and that's where we're like, it's almost like Pit. It's like cars, like NASCAR.
Sure.
NASCAR, same concept. And you're like, look at how great the New England robot fixers are.
You can combine video gaming with robotics.
And they go in there, and they get hits, and I think I would still react to a big hit. I love robot number 62.
You know, like, lasers and, I don't know,
I don't care that they're human beings playing now.
Get Elon Musk's flamethrowers attached to them.
I'm onto something. So if there are investors out there, you know, obviously they're bringing the XFL back. I say robot FL. We could do that.
Absolutely.
All right. My rabbit hole story is a story that Bill Ruthart had today. I wanted to put it underreported, but I also feel like it's rabbit hole. But it's about the mayor's neighborhood development fund. So essentially, get this, and I don't think a lot of people know this, but Mayor Emanuel's approach to zoning. We've seen in the last week or two big projects. Right behind the Trib Tower, there's going to be a skyscraper that goes the second tallest in the city. A new one out west as you go close to the United Center that is, they want to make it 60 stories. There's nothing over four. stories in that area. Now, back in the day, that was
another
a
one
big,
in Fulton.
Yeah, another. You know, there back in the day, there was like, oh, that's just not. You know, there are rules on the books. What the mayor has done is said, if you want to break the code, if you want to break the zoning code, you have to pay a fine. Mm-hmm. And this would be, and that fine, that money will be used for other neighborhoods, a neighborhood fund to help with impoverished neighborhoods or neighborhoods that need help that don't have resources. Well, yeah, developers are like, I don't care about a fine.
Sure.
And so they are building, you see cranes everywhere, and they're breaking zoning codes everywhere. And the mayor, and today it was, I believe it was someone in the mayor's office, Reifman, who said that they've got more money than they know what to do with. And that's crazy. Like, it was something where I had to look at the story, but it was something where it was millions of dollars.
$6.9 million.
Yeah. They say Reifman expects another 14 projects to pay $50.1 million into the city in 2018.
Yeah, as it turns out, luxury taxes do not work.
They don't work, yeah. Right. And he's gonna have $100 million, and they said he's gonna use it for election time.
It's
meaning
great
that right
him.
Before the election, he's going to dole out grant after grant after grant to these communities where he wants people to vote for him.
500 sure. grants in South and West Side communities.
Now, I don't think that's a bad thing. I'm glad that the grants are going there, but to ruin the aesthetic and the culture of certain neighborhoods to be able to have this money to
hand it out.
I don't know. There's something about it that seems somewhat suspect.
Well, and it's basically, well, not that TIFs are super heavily regulated, but it's an unregulated TIF. It's a slush fund that, you know, what's going to be done with it. Maybe there's going to be some beneficial actions towards election time. Hopefully so. But, you know, he can do whatever he wants with it. And the mayor of Chicago usually does whatever he wants.
Yeah, and I remember that Mayor Daley had a lot of trouble with TIFs. I really do. I remember that being something, not even TIFs, but just zoning, mm-hmm. where he wouldn't he'd turn a blind eye, if you will, and he'd let the alderman deal with it, and it gives a lot of corruption that came to the alderman. So I understand the idea of maybe centralizing it. But at the same time, I also felt that the mayor was very effective in saying, if you're trying to break a zoning code and it went through the mayor's office, he wouldn't do it.
Yeah,
I remember there was the project on Fulton back in the day when it was all meatpacking over there, where they started to build a big thing there because they had paid or greased the wheels to make it happen. And when the story goes that the mayor drove through there and saw it and said, this is not that kind of zoning, shut it down. And that building stayed unvacated or half built for 10, 15 years. Mm. But this concept of a fund on top, it's just going, I don't know if that's going to work, because I know, living in the West Loop myself, there are a lot of people starting to get angry about skyscrapers.
Block views.
Or just, and not even block views, just density.
Mm.
This idea that you're going to build a 60-story off of Fulton.
Right.
Have you been on Fulton? It's a one-way street. So how are you going to do that? So I think that's an interesting story that the mayor is got a huge fund, neighborhood fund, off of letting some of these zoning things lapse.
As long as we get some more condos. That's really important.
That's really important. All right, Craig, Randy, we're down to the last category here, which is, which story is going to be remembered in 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 500 years from this week? Craig, what do you think? What do you got on your list?
Well, you stole my space story, so I'm going to go with Amazon. The pendulum seems to be swinging a little bit. I'm Johnny Negative here at the end of the show, but it seems to be swinging a little bit against Amazon lately. And you know, there's been some good reporting on the ill effects of Amazon in poorer communities, and you can argue whether or not Chicago is one of those. But I think we haven't really discussed enough what the implications of us getting an Amazon HQ2 would be, and it's starting to trickle up to the surface.
And this week was the first where there was a lawsuit that was filed to essentially force the city and the state to be transparent with what was the offer. Because up to this point, they've just been, we're not going to tell you what it is. That's crazy, right? All right, what do you got? Randy, what do you got for...
You know, I thought long and hard about this, and I really, to answer the question honestly, I feel like it's weak that nothing that happened this week will be talked about in 50... I mean, despite how interesting our conversation was tonight, and I think it was, I really don't feel like anything consequential came from our state, our city, our nation that anybody will care about in 10 years.
You sound like you need a support animal.
I don't. I mean, I really don't think. I mean, and that says something. I mean, they'll replay State of the Unions as one of the longest ones ever, but I can't think of any clips that will show.
Well, I thought this week, and I had this on my list somewhere else, and I'll adapt it. The Mars rover selfie.
Great photo.
A great photo of and I think what it was is it reminded us that those were still working and operational. I'm going to have one of the scientists on coming up in the next week, but oh my, those things were supposed to die. They were supposed, the rovers were 90-day lifespan. Some of these are, I mean, this one that took the selfie today was launched in 2011. And to have 7 years of space exploration and to be able to still get a quality selfie from these rovers and to see the planet, I think that we're going to start to see more, I think, more looking at that planet as a planet that could be used for some sort of human capacity. I don't mean living on or anything like that, but it's just amazing how far science has gone to the point that there are pictures that are awesome quality of its planet. I was blown away. I was showing my son today. I'm like, this is crazy. Uh-huh. It's crazy that right now we're watching it like the next feed's going to be Kim Kardashian. Yep. You know, but right now here's planet Mars.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
Just imagine when the Tesla's up there.
Exactly, riding around. Mm. Lots of great stuff. People text in saying the NFL denying the AmVets taking out their ad in the Super Bowl program. That was the story. 630 says at least animals have tickets. What kind of security do we have with the woman who keeps getting on planes without a ticket? That's true.
A great question.
That is such a great question. There's so much good stuff. Craig Newman, Randy Velasomo, reloading this week's news. Guys, great to see you. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend. Yeah.